Hello, and welcome to the School of Attraction podcast. I'm Damien Deeker, and I'll be talking to you about a range of topics from dating, attraction, masculinity, sexuality, life philosophy, and much, much more. So, without any further ado, let's get started. I hope you enjoy listening to today's podcast just as much as I've enjoyed creating it. Hey everyone, welcome back. And today I'm going to be, today's actually an interesting one. I'm going to be interviewing Dr. Mandy. First of all, Dr. Mandy, how are you?
I'm fantastic. How are you?
I'm doing very well. And this is actually, this is an interesting one for me because I've known you since you were just out of high school, 18?
Pretty much. Yeah, 18. That would have been it. Sometime.
And yeah, let's not talk about how long that's been.
Yeah, no.
But I mean, I've watched you grow up. I mean, even back then, you're already playing a role as an admin on sex health forums and things.
Yeah, that's right. So it's been quite a long journey into sexual health and sexology for me. But I think that's the beauty of having such nice long friendships is that you get to see each other grow, and that's a beautiful part of life.
Yeah, it is. And it's been really cool to see. Like, you know, you can imagine for a lot of you guys listening, I mean, I've watched Mandy go from this girl out of high school trying to work out what she wants and just like get your PhD and you've just, you've just done some really amazing stuff. But to do a proper introduction, just because I'm kind of reminiscing at the same time, sorry, people. So Mandy, you're a qualified sex therapist and a psychosocial sexologist. Is that correct?
Pretty much. I mean, there's a lot of terms that can be thrown around for what I do for a living, but basically, yeah. So I'm a sex therapist and also a psychosocial sexologist, which is just a very long, fancy way of saying that I do research in the topic areas of sex, sexuality, sexual pleasure, gender identity, and so on and so forth.
Cool. And now this is actually in many ways why I reached out to you, because, you know, you and I have had lots of chats in the past and we haven't always, like, you tend to lean slightly left, I tend to lean slightly right, but then I'm kind of a bit more center than anything, but still more right than you on a number of issues. But we've always had really amazing chats, especially around stuff like gender identity, sexuality, all this kind of stuff. And so I want to preface this conversation that you and I are going to have by an experience that I had that made me think, you know what, you and I should have this chat.
Yeah,
in front of everyone.
Absolutely.
So my partner, well, my ex and I, we were in an open relationship, and I was on Tinder, meeting girls, going on dates, doing all this kind of stuff. And there was this one girl who I was having a chat to, and, you know, she looked really hot in her photos, and we're having a talk. And then I said to her, you know, let's meet up, let's grab a coffee and see if we click. And she said, great, that sounds awesome, but I got to tell you, I'm transgender. And it was a really interesting experience that I had in my head at that point, because I felt very not free to make a decision without feeling judgment about myself. It was really, really weird set of emotions I went through. I went through this whole sort of what would that mean if I even said yes to go on a date with her?
Yeah.
Right? What would that mean about me? What would other people think? Would I hide that from people? Would I even want to tell my partner about it? I suddenly had all these like feelings and emotions And so what I did is I thought, well, that's interesting. That's going on internally. That has to be unpacked. So I thought, I'm a member of a couple of really great men's groups on Facebook that, you know, pretty good, solid guys give feedback. And I threw out my experience on there and the topic exploded. And it exploded because so many men, I wasn't aware how much shame was going to be thrown at me by some of these guys. Like, you know, guys saying, oh, look, if she's got a dick, she's a guy, you're gay. You just haven't admitted it yet. Just admit it. And just so much of that as though just really harsh judgment, and way more than I expected from a men's group. And I thought, Jesus, if that's in a men's group, that's out there in the world.
Yeah.
Even more strongly, because generally men's groups are usually more understanding about this stuff. And so what I wanted to do is I thought, well, you know, if I've had this experience around just even thinking about transgender women, I know that the prevalence of men, and I'm sure you can probably give me more feedback on this, but from my understanding, having talked to like friends who are transgender and whatnot, a lot more men are open or interested in transgender women than will publicly ever say anything.
Yeah. And there's a lot to unpack even just in that statement. So, and the key phrase there is, opening up about it. So we know that it's, of course, a natural part of life to be curious about all kinds of bodies and types of people, and that is to be able to indulge in thinking about those desires or curiosities is, first of all, a really good step in being open. So, yeah, it's definitely more common than people realize. However, there is kind of two sides to the coin of this. So on the one hand, straight cis men who, like I said, who are open or welcome experiences with trans women or trans femme people, I do use those different terms because trans woman can be like has a sense of final destination, whereas trans femme can be more like, or more on the feminine leaning side of the trans spectrum. Yeah. So I just want to sort of specify the difference between those two terms there. But yeah, those who are a bit more welcoming of those experiences, I would say, are a lot more enlightened because they're actually looking past what society has told them they're, you know, quote unquote, allowed to engage in or think about or desire or be curious about, because they're thinking beyond that status quo of the binary of sex, gender, and sexuality, which is normally what we call heteronormative. And that is very, you know, cis man, cis woman. Cis, for those who don't know, means not trans. So when we think of heteronormative sex or heteronormative desire, it's very man, woman, penis in vagina sex or PIV sex. So being able to even think beyond that is a really good step in kind of challenging those expectations and going, oh, well, wait a minute, like what if I am curious about this, or what if, you know, I do want to engage in these sorts of things. So that's what I would call a really good first step. However, there is a darker side to the coin as well, in that there are some cis men who fetishize trans femmes or trans women people, which is not okay, obviously. So that's more not being open to all kinds of people, but more seeing someone as an actual like object of their desire rather than seeing it as a you know, another person who has their own needs and wants and desires. The difference, I guess, is kind of comparable with how some white cis men can fetishize race as well. So that's something that's a bit more talked about in some circles. So there's a very big difference between saying, you know, I'm open to sleeping with Asian women versus I will only sleep with Asian women. Do you know what I mean? So it's that real sinister objectification at play, and that's obviously a lot less okay. And that can happen with attraction towards trans women as well. So
yeah. I kind of feel like, even though it's off topic slightly, I feel like I need to unpack
that
somewhat.
Yeah.
Because in my gut, I feel like there's something there.
Yeah.
That I've never spoken to people about before.
Oh, interesting. Yeah,
because I kind of get the notion with the race thing, where you get men, but I'd like to hear how you really see the difference, because that distinction there from your definition, it didn't quite hit the mark, and I feel like I kind of know what you're getting at.
Yeah, sure. So I'm just trying to think of another way to sort of explain this. So obviously there's there's a lot of different kinds of determinants as to who we are as people in, you know, health contexts and all sorts of things. Gender, sexuality, and race are three very different ones. But the reason why I use race as an example is because sometimes in some circles that's talked about a bit more than, say, trans experiences. So there's a very big difference between being open to being with all sorts of people and then, you know, the real fetishization of a particular person for a certain reason. And it's a very different thing if that person is coming forward and going, hell yeah, I want to be the subject of your desire and I'm going to really lean into this. But that's a very specific dynamic and not really reflective of the more bigger issue of how some men can treat certain kinds of women based on a very specific box.
But it feels like it's more so when I've seen it expressed or talked to female friends, or I guess trans friends, the way that the way that it's been conveyed to me is more than just someone only likes that race or only likes trans women. But it almost feels like there's a different, so I'll use race because that triggered it for me.
Sure.
That thought.
Yeah.
Where you get a number of guys get locked in where they kind of lock, because of the way sex tourism has worked and all this kind of stuff, there can be an instant response to certain races of girls to the prostitution experiences that they've had. Mm-hmm. And then that somehow gets locked. And then those women, those girls, regular women, you know, not sex workers, get treated in the same way those guys would treat the sex workers.
Mm.
And that's the way that I've seen it with race coming through. With the women, it's like these guys will date non-Asian women as well. But when it comes to Asian women, they just end up treating them differently because of that other experience they've had or that other link they have in their heads.
Sure.
And that is what you're referring to, isn't it? Is it's like, I guess you say it's the objectification. So it's a sexual tool versus a person who happens to be that sex.
More or less. And that's a bigger issue that I'll sort of touch on a little bit more about later about the reasons why cis men may be attracted to trans women. There's a lot of expectations around what trans women may or may not be able to offer them, and that in itself becomes very transactional and isn't very healthy or kind.
Yes.
That sort of ties into a later point that I'll sort of get into as well about the expectations there. Yeah.
Sure. So let me try to get back on topic.
Sure.
Because back onto the topic of, I guess what I feel I'd like to do, what I was wanting to do, is be a little bit devil's advocate.
Yeah.
And I guess throw some of the challenges at you that men are thinking and feeling when this topic comes up.
Yeah, for sure.
One of the most obvious ones is, it doesn't matter if you're attracted to someone, if you want to sleep with someone and they have a penis, that means part of you's gay if you're still turned on by them. How would you unpack that?
Ooh, okay, so here's the thing with statements like that is that those are coming from some very rigid perspectives about what we are told we're allowed to find attractive as a society and what we are told what equals what. So, you know, a lot of the time, most of the time in Western culture, people are raised to believe that, you know, boys and men have penises, women have and girls have vaginas, and, you know, all these sorts of very, you know, cookie cutter A is B and things like that. There's very limited education around the actual spectrum of what bodies are and what gender is. And I'd like to think that that's slowly changing over time. But that's where a lot of these things kind of come from. So a lot of this has to do with the notion of passing, which is a term that's often used a lot in or referring to trans people about whether or not they pass, quote unquote, as a man or a woman. And so that's where this whole kind of, weird mythology around a trans penis kind of comes into play, as is in people go, well, if they still have this object, then that means that they still fit into this box. But what is it that makes us associate that box? You know what I'm saying? So it's not just the putting it in the box, but it's also, well, why can't we just be attracted to that body regardless of what else is or is not on that body? It's, you know, if you want to really step back, you can sort of say, well, you know, if someone is only attracted to blondes and then they want to go out with a brunette, like, oh, where's the stigma there? Like, it's a different kind of body. So, and this is really where those social influences really come in, is that, and even when you want to unpack that further again, you can look at, well, why does a sexual act define your sexuality in the first place, and what does that have to do with your identity? I mean, there's a whole subculture of men who aren't gay and who aren't bi, but do engage in sex with other men, but it has zero to do with their identity. So, and that is, you know, obviously far more on the masculine male spectrum of sex and gender. So, that's sort of a lot of the things that ties into that kind of really big assumption about masculinity as well, in that, you know, dating someone, even dating a cis woman who might look masculine can be a threat to masculinity. Or ironically, when men spend a lot of time with their wife or with their female partner and they get given a hard time by their male friends and get called, you know, gay or under the thumb or something like that. So even the most heterosexual act is still perceived as being a threat to masculinity. So it's quite an interesting line of thought.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think that's a little bit, for me, what I experienced is a little bit nail on the head. I felt identity threat. I felt identity threat. And the big question, of course, was, well, that's ridiculous. Why would, what about this threatens my identity? Because I don't, if I woke up tomorrow and realized I was gay, it wouldn't change my life too dramatically.
Yeah.
My friends wouldn't care. Well, my parents might care a bit, but that doesn't bother me so much. You know, my life wouldn't have to change so dramatically. So then why would my identity be threatened? Like, why would I feel that threat? But it's really there, you know? And I guess you're right, because I see it with guys too. You know, as a dating coach, I see a lot of men really judge each other for the attractiveness of the women they date. It's like, oh, well, she's a little too overweight. And it's like, well, wait, why are you, if he's happy with this person, why is this a problem? It's just really wild. And I guess, yeah, it's definitely a huge part.
Yeah, absolutely.
But what's strange too is when we talk about, okay, if she's got a penis, then she's a guy. What's interesting, because I was really trying to unpack what I was feeling, you know, and think through what was being said. If I just picture in my head woman and like, what's turning me on, I'm not actually thinking of her vagina. I'm thinking about her body, like her shape. You know, her hips, her legs, even her boobs, her butt. Like, funnily enough, the last thing I'm thinking about is her vagina.
Yeah, exactly.
Even though, you know, in some funny way, well, that's what I'm trying to get to. But it's not what I'm picturing. It's not the shape that's appearing in my mind when I'm going there. And I think that's probably true for most guys. I assume with most things like this, I'm more or less normal for a regular straight cis guy. But, you know, maybe I shouldn't make that assumption always. But it's an interesting one, and that was one of the big ones. It's a hard thing, because I know that a lot of guys have that notion locked in their heads of something has to be masculine or feminine.
Yeah.
But then, okay, then let me throw this out, which is not my feeling, but it's something else that you come across a lot, is they'll say, well, the thing is, it's all lovely and well to speak about a spectrum, but let's be honest, 90% of people are either a male or a female. And really, we're just splitting hairs for like a really small number of people.
I'd say probably closer to about 80, but yeah, fair call.
And so where am I going with that question? I'm going with that question because I think that that's used then as a reason why we should stop trying to split hairs on gender. And yet the more that I've dived, because I've been of late really interested in men's shame and men's sexuality and dark sexual, like the stuff that we keep hidden from ourselves and other people. And the more I get into it with and talking to other men in depth, the more I realize, I mean, everyone, men and women, are a lot more, not just like with our sexual preference for people, but we've got a lot more sexual kink than we want to admit. I mean, it's more normal to be sexually kinky than it is to be sexually bland and vanilla, I think.
Yeah.
But no one wants to talk about it, so bland remains the standard normal. Have you ever spoken with a guy? I mean, obviously I'm not looking for you to name the guy, but have you ever had an experience where you're talking a guy through, he's interested in transgender women or testing those waters? Have you ever had an experience talking a guy through that, and what has helped him, or how have you gotten to him to a place where he could make a healthy, non-judgmental decision about what he wants to do there?
Sure. So yes and no. In some more general context, I've definitely had some of those conversations with cis men. I think what's very important is to, first of all, there's a lot of really interesting language that you've used there about exploring dark desires and things that we're not supposed to talk about. And that in itself is very reflective of why we even have to have this conversation, is that there's a lot of repression about anything that is not the social norm that is expected of us. And that includes any kind of diversity, be it gender diversity, sexuality diversity, a lot of the time even cultural and ethnicity diversity. There are a lot of, you know, especially from older generations who don't like their kids dating outside their culture, you know? So it's not just limited to trans bodies and gender diverse people. But what I have done is, first of all, get people to think about why that desire may be occurring. So is there anything else more quote-unquote sinister behind that desire? So is it that they are wanting to simply just explore different kinds of women, in which case I obviously encourage that. That's wonderful. But a lot of the time, like I mentioned before, there is that darker side to the coin of, well, what is it about trans women specifically that is piquing your curiosity? Is it because you think that's going to meet a particular need of yours? And let's more unpack that. What's that going to tell you? What's that about? Because a lot of the time, and this is me speaking a bit more colloquially based on my experiences of talking with some other trans femme friends of mine, so not necessarily an academic perspective, but there's a very big expectation on performance for trans women, and that comes from that very fetishizing aspect. So a lot of the time cis men might approach trans women and sort of be like, okay, what I really want is to experience a penis, but I don't want to actually go to men for it. So this is more of a, you know, a safe way of approaching this. And that is not a healthy relationship with a trans woman. And a lot of the time that's why some cis men will go to trans sex workers. But again, it's also not how trans bodies work. Trans bodies undergo a lot of shifting and adjusting with hormones a lot of the time for those who do undergo hormone therapy. Certainly not all trans people do. But what that's doing is placing such a huge expectation based on what men may have seen most likely in porn. And that's obviously a whole other big can of worms that we can open about how incorrect that all is. So there can be this, you know, expectation of walking into a room being like, right, okay, I want you to get hard and fuck me. And trans women are like, bro, this is not how this works. there's a lot more that has to kind of happen, and there's medication involved, and it's a whole thing. And so that's also part of that real fetishizing thing of trans women, because it can actually be what kind of feels for some cis men, certainly not all, but some cis men may feel like that's a safer way to explore their sexuality, but by still being with women. But what they're really doing is minimizing their own same-sex experiences, and also really minimizing the experience of being a woman for that trans woman, which is, you know, extremely unfair and very objectifying and all sorts. So circling back to sort of answering that question is, what would I do beyond that is, first of all, make sure that that's not what they're trying to achieve, because if they're actually wanting to explore some same-sex play, then a trans woman is certainly not the answer, because that person is a woman. And what I would do is more approach this in a more healthy interpersonal way. So this is a bit easier if they're in a relationship with someone and they're not sure what to do. So what I would encourage instead is to encourage that person to remove this desired person from the box that they've put them in, or that society has forced them to put them in, and to really look at that person specifically. So what does this person, be it a trans person or intersex person or whoever's got any kind of diversity within their body, what do they like? How do they like to be touched, loved, and how do they experience pleasure in a way that is unique to them? So I think a lot of the time people approach trans women and treat them either like a cis woman's body or like a cis man's body, which is even worse. And that can be where a lot of problems can occur, in that no one's going to be having a good time and everyone's going to be very confused about, well, why is this person treating me this way? So yeah, it's a lot more unpacking about how to actually interact with an individual person's body. Because when we really break it down, all sex tissue is the same. In utero, all infants or fetuses start out as female. And then what happens is testosterone kind of kicks in, and that makes the clitoris grow into more of a longer phallic shape. And so really it's all just working with the same gear, just in slightly different shapes. And so what we need to remind ourselves is, first of all, that in that we're all made of the same kind of, you know, stardust and goo and all that kind of thing. But what we need to actually communicate with each other about what does feel good. And rather than going, oh, I'm going to treat this person like they're, you know, X, Y, or Z, just ask that person, like, what feels good for you? What's a good stopping point for you? How can I make you feel sexually pleasured and validated in the body and gender of your choosing? That's a very long answer.
Yeah, it is a very, it's interesting, you know, because I think, I mean, the funny thing is what comes up for me is that kind of dialogue really needs to happen in regular cis man, cis woman sexual interactions.
Absolutely.
Too, but it doesn't. People are technically very bad at trying to work out what their sexual partners want. It's not part of, it should be part of more dialogues, but it's rarely part of a dialogue. Which is a crazy thing. I mean, even in a casual sex relationship, it's so much more fun if you're learning about each other's turn-ons.
Absolutely.
And bodies, and what do you actually like? What's going to, you know, those conversations don't happen very often. And so, yes, it's a funny thing, but those conversations should be part of sex and then in general.
Oh, yeah, 100%. I definitely endorse that, that any person in any kind of relationship should be doing that. And even people should be doing that with themselves too, which is also very uncommon. Like, take the time to sit and learn about your own body. What feels good for you? And yeah, so that's obviously part of a much bigger discussion around pleasure. But what makes this, I guess, a bit more stand out over kind of cishet relationships, cisgendered heterosexual relationships, is more that that we're working here with a population of people who experience a lot of trauma and a lot of dysphoria about their bodies. So there's a lot of sometimes they can barely even touch themselves because they want to look different to what they are. And that's not just including gender, that can be about any kind of body dysmorphia. So it's really important to consider that trauma, and that's why these conversations become even more important.
It's something that I sent you some thoughts that I was having off the back of this, and something that I wanted to bring up, which relates well, is the notion of how I am as a guy, as a cis guy, imbued with a sense of what it means to be masculine.
Yeah.
Because I think it's actually a very blurry answer. You know, I've had a number of people, when I tell them like I'm working on this stuff, and they say, "Oh, cool. What's masculine? What do you see as being really?" And it feels like, because I know when we talked, you said you should have a read of some Foucault, and that's some heavy reading.
Yeah, I'm not gonna lie.
But even his work, I can see, has clearly found its way to some of the other work that I've read in the past as well. Because I did follow your
very big foundation work for a lot of things. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, I've long understood that even if you look back at human history, our notion of what was masculine is wildly different depending on when and where you're looking.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I mentioned to you in the thing, like, my understanding about the ancient Greeks too was like literally an insult you could give a guy was he wasn't masculine enough to have sex with men.
Yeah.
That was an insult, you know.
Yeah. And most married, well, not most, but certainly a lot of married men of status would have younger boys that they would engage in sexual acts with, and that was a very normal thing to do.
It was questionable if you didn't. And that's, I think, I mean, the Greeks are an easy one to I guess pick on, because they were such a historically, in the way that we're taught history, they're such a relevant
absolutely
group. Anthropologically, but I mean, there have been lots of examples, right? I mean, that's the problem, is whenever we try to question how are humans meant to be sexually, it's never as obvious as men are only supposed to have sex with women in a long-term married relationship under the sanctity of God. I mean, that whole notion is really just a couple of thousand years old, and you go past that, and everything is radically different, right?
Absolutely. And even the idea of marrying for love is a fairly new idea. That's only a couple of hundred years old. Before it was purely transactional. It wasn't actually until the invention of the novel where we started to see a lot of romance stories, and that's actually what kind of led to the rise of marrying for love instead, which is quite fascinating. But again, that's kind of a whole other fun thing to look at. But the issue is that there is a lot of very diverse ways that we look at sexuality and gender. There are many cultures that recognize, 3 to 5 genders, and that's just a very normal part of life in those cultures. But the issue that we have is that being part of a dominant Western white culture is that we do have a particular expectation around heteronormative sex, you know, men, woman, penis and vagina, that's it, nothing else, which, you know, is absurd and very limiting and very boring, really. As a result, we are sort of raised with a lot of these very narrow views on what is and is not acceptable and how some of these acts can then reflect on who we are as people. So as you mentioned Foucault before, who, for a bit more context for listeners, is a French philosopher that underpins a lot of philosophy and sociology and psychology to a point as well. Foucault discussed how sexual identities were actually born out of the categorization of sexual acts themselves. So homosexuality just was not a thing. It was just sometimes two people would of the same sex or gender would have sex, and it wasn't anything. It was just a thing that someone did sometime.
Like playing football.
Exactly. Whereas it wasn't until we had this kind of medicalization of homosexuality. So once that act had a name, and that act became associated with, you know, a group of people who would do that, you know, these homosexuals, right? And that once it was named, it could then be othered. And so then it was, oh, here's what we do, but if you do that, then you're this kind of person, and we now demonize that kind of person. And that then became the foundation for a lot of laws, particularly in Britain in the late 1800s. And it's those sort of attitudes and some laws that still continue in a lot of countries today.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and they have deep roots in religion.
Of course. Yeah, yeah. So the
religion has a lot to answer for, but that's a totally different conversation.
It's the big three. It's a law, religion, medicine. That's basically to blame for all of our social constrictions.
Lovely. And so, do you have any this is a wild card question to ask you, Mandy, and you may not have a good answer for it, but I'm going to throw it at you anyway. Do you have any notion of what it would look like in a world where there was no, if there was no shame with guys in general, around sexual activity one way or another? How do we best, from what our research shows, how do we think people would behave? Because I remember, like, it was really old research at this point, but when they used to believe that, like, men tended to be very polarized sexually between whether they were gay or straight. It was women had a lot more overlap. And I believe that's really old research now. How do you see that this would actually look? Like, do you think in general experimentation, but like men and women would be a lot more prevalent? Well, let's focus on men because they're our audience. But do you think that would actually be a lot more prevalent? Or do you think still men would generally just be very polarized?
I think there definitely would be a lot more playing, a lot more experimentation, because it is that suppression of desire. Like, suppression of desire stems from the very fear of shame. So you can even see it in practice. Like, there's no biological reason for women to be, to have higher prevalences of bisexuality than men, but we do see that, and it's purely because there is so much shame and stigma for bisexual men. So by living, if there was a way to remove that, then absolutely, I think it would be a lot more common, and we do see that in cultures that that aren't heavily influenced by Western culture. And that there is a lot more diversity, and not even just in sexuality expression, but also within gender expression as well. So, yeah, I think that there's a lot to be said for just what kind of influence that social expectations can place upon men and women. But yeah, so it's very it's difficult to articulate exactly, but that's the thing in that if we didn't have shame, at what point are we removing what obstacles? So are we removing the labels of sexuality? Are we removing laws? Are we removing religion? So I guess that also determines in just how free these things can be.
I wonder how big an impact this has as well on non-sexual male intimacy. I mean, I remember, because I a few years ago I was in Ubud in Bali for a while, and that is a very hippie place, and there is a lot more male intimacy, non-sexual. I'm sure there's probably more male sexual intimacy too, but I'm talking about non-sexual now, like just hugging hello between guys, like properly hugging, not like, you know, Western male hug, but properly hugging.
That's beautiful.
Like, that kind of connection with other men. And that felt really good. Like when I was around that, it was weird at first, because I was just stepping into this whole world from Sydney, Australia, and then just stepping into this place where it felt weird. But then I missed it. Coming back to the Western world, I missed that intimacy. with other guys. And I wonder how big an impact that has on boys, teenagers, men, because we here, you very purposely avoid all kinds of physical intimacy, right? Non-sexual. Because it's too closely linked to homosexuality. Yeah. I mean, that's really entirely why men hug awkwardly here. And I wonder how much emotionally that impacts us, because we miss that out on that. Like, women get that from female friends.
Yeah.
We don't. At least in the Western world.
I think that is a really fascinating point, and absolutely has massive ties to, you know, this very homophobic sensation that, you know, you can't touch a friend because you might look gay, which is absurd. And it is deeply ingrained in our culture. In fact, there's I'm trying to think who talks about this. I think it's Dax Shepard talks about this a bit on his podcast, because he grew up in Detroit and, you know, so very all about cars, very masculine, very homophobic. But him and his best friend, who was a male, would often, you know, whenever they'd have sleepovers, they'd spoon all night and cuddle. And there was certainly nothing sexual about it. It was just a beautiful platonic expression. And he says it's one of his, you know, the only times that he's felt, you know, the safest, when he had this, you know, very nice comfort from his best friend. And a lot of men would not engage in that behavior. And he talks about it quite a lot in terms of how confronting that would be for most men, but how they really love
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. I would find that. I like to think of myself as very open-minded, but that would be, yeah, I'd feel like all kinds of weird about that as well with any male friend. And that's possibly sad, but it's one of those things where I can't separate my upbringing from what might be organic. It's a very hard thing to separate out.
Yeah, and it's a very sad, unfortunate thing, because there is a lot of really nice bonding that can happen between same-sex friendships that a lot of men do miss out on as a result. I mean, even just touch builds a kind of intimacy. It doesn't have to be romantic or sexual, but it builds a kind of intimacy, and it could be possible even that if we increase physical intimacy between men, that we could also increase emotional intimacy, because that is very heavily tied in, of course. And so if we remove some of this stigma, then men might also be more comfortable talking about problems with their friends. And I spoke to a male friend of mine recently about, you know, what would happen if, you know, he ever got divorced, and he just said, "Oh, I wouldn't tell anybody." I'm like, "I don't understand what you mean. What do you mean you wouldn't tell anybody?" It's like, "Oh, I just wait until people assumed." And it was a really big indicator of, you know, how much he would fear as a man admitting that he was, you know, sad or felt pain to other male friends. And so, yeah, I think that sounds really beautiful, being able to be around that kind of increased platonic physical intimacy between men.
I mean because I've been going through a breakup the last few months, and it's only really been my female friends who I've had proper conversations about my real emotional raw stuff. You know, with the guys it always feels somehow stymied. You know, it's like, yeah, I'm sad.
Yeah.
It sucks.
And that's as far as it goes.
But with the female friends, it's like I really go into what I'm feeling and experiencing, because I, for whatever reason, I just feel like that's a safer space, and that's a sad thing. And it's not because there's anything wrong with my male friends, it's just the dynamic that I think gets created.
Yeah. I'm very curious as to whether or not that may also be a boundary in some same-sex relationships as well. I do know someone who's sort of recently come out as being a bisexual man, which has, like I said before, a lot of stigma, and he's sort of venturing into trying to date men for the first time, and it can be really hard because he's fishing for more of that kind of emotional connection, and he's just not getting much back because men just don't open up the way that women do. Certainly not all, but a lot of the time as a result of you know, social conditioning and whatnot. So,
Yeah, it's not a standard part of upbringing.
Which is very sad. It's a lot a lot that can be gained from being very emotionally open. So, yeah, that's a Western society for you, sadly.
It really is. Something that I – correct me if you think this is bad advice, actually. This is a better way to say it. But I think it's – because I think a number of the men listening to this are listening this far because this whole topic is of interest to them. They're questioning things, or they're thinking about questioning things, or something in the back of their head's itching. For me, one of the biggest things in my own world, anything to do with shadow stuff, stuff where there's shame attached to it, the most powerful thing you can have is someone, anyone who you can vocalize it to who won't judge. The quality of their advice is far less important than the fact that you are what you would call bringing it into the light. Because when you share stuff openly that you would normally feel shame around, every time you do it, even if the advice or the feedback given by that person isn't useful, so long as they're not judging you, your shame levels drop dramatically.
Yeah,
just shedding light on it. And I think a lot of, and you guys listening, you need at least a few friends that you can share stuff with where you know they're not going to try to make you feel ashamed of the stuff that's happening internally. I think that's a critical thing for anyone to be able to start to explore anything, whether it's sexuality or anything else. Because I think one of the healthiest things you can do is bring that stuff up. Do you think that, to what degree do you think that a person's blindness around their, you know, forget sexuality for a second and just call it kink, right? The things that turn us on, because I think a lot of people aren't really 100% sure what turns them on. What might turn them on? They're really not, they don't give it enough thought because they don't want to. Outside of vanilla. To what degree do you think discovering that for a person, even though it's in theory just limited to our sexual lives, to what degree do you think a person going through that journey helps to get them to tap into who they really are? It helps them to self-express in all parts of their life. Do you think there's a connection there? Because I've long thought there was, but I'm curious to see your thoughts on
that. Yeah, I mean, it's very important to acknowledge all parts of the self. And I do want to be very clear and say that there's a very big difference between acknowledging and action. It sounds like what you're referring to is what's called shadow work, which is something that I do quite a bit with clients. And it's where we try to, for those who don't know, it's where we try to work out what our subconscious self is telling us versus what we're putting out. So what we put out is very external. It's our own ego's persona to the world. So it's filtered based on what we fear may come back to us if we're very honest. And that all gets quite repressed over time. So some of the ways in which that you can find out what some of those things are is to look inward and think about what we might be in denial about or what we're projecting. So what makes us have a bigger reaction than normal, which some people may call overreacting, but I'm trying to avoid that term. These are some other sorts of key things to think about when we're thinking about the shadow self and what is in our subconscious and how can we pull that out and see that. So a lot of the time the reasons these things are squashed so far down is because they're tied up in sociocultural expectations or subjective experiences. So it may be either that, well, society tells you that, you can't be attracted to men or whoever, or it may be, you know, when you were very young, your parents might've told you this explicitly. So it can be a number of things that shapes, various aspects of what lives within that shadow. A really good example of this kind of denial projection is if anyone's seen the movie American Beauty, there's great movie. I'm going to say spoiler for American Beauty, so switch to a couple minutes later if you don't want to hear about this. But the movie's old, so I'm just going to do it anyway. And there's a character in that that's very rampantly homophobic, and then we realize later that sort of actually really projecting an inward desire that they've never felt they've been able to explore. And that's a really good example of what shadow work is and can be, and that it's become very repressed and has become pushed outward in a very, very denial-based kind of persona. So basically what I'm getting at is that it's very important to acknowledge the parts of the self. It doesn't mean that you need to act upon them, because some things in reality can be very dark and very unsafe to explore for either that person or others. And I certainly wouldn't encourage anything that is damaging to the self or other people. But while it's important to acknowledge that we are all, all animals at our core, we are still social creatures, and so we do still need to be aware that, you know, we are socialized enough to be able to say, hey, no, that's unsafe, don't do that. But it's more about the acknowledgement of that of that darker part of the self. And whatever that darkness looks like to you, like that may be something that, you know, is quite dangerous, or it might be something like same-sex attraction, or it could be any great number of things that is a darkness to you based on your subjective experiences or the way in which you've moved through the world, you know, be it Western or otherwise. And what we can do by trying to bring that more into the light is to find out what it is by asking ourselves some of those questions, like what makes me have bigger reactions than other people to certain things? Where does that come from? You know, what makes me feel very angry? And by acknowledging that, we can then sort of say to ourselves, okay, well, I fear or I desire this, and that's okay. And just accepting that part of ourself to fully embrace all parts of the self. But yeah, it doesn't necessarily require action, but just that acknowledgement of knowing, hey, this is a part of who I am, and that's okay.
It's a great sense of peace in that. I've found, as I've done that with different parts of me and who I am.
Yeah, it's very much more for the peace and acknowledgement of the self, rather than for desire fulfillment. That sort of separate, again, cannot be more clear about that.
Yeah, no, that is true. Well, I mean, that's often with when I'm talking to men specifically, I often liken their shadow or their dark sexuality to a guard dog, and that dog can be allowed off the leash to go around and attack everyone, or it can be well trained. You know, it's still a guard dog, still the same animal, still has the same urges, but it's how it's raised that makes
absolutely.
All the difference.
It's a really good analogy. I like that.
And that guard dog, in many ways, keeps you safe too. That's just it.
You know, yeah, a lot of things in our subconscious, or a lot of things that we do that can be perceived as aggressive or childlike are there for a reason. It's because at some point those actions have protected us, but a lot of the time that's protecting us when we were children, and that's no longer relevant as adults. We need to learn to move forward in a healthier way. Yeah.
Yeah. Bit maladaptive at that point. Is there, as we sort of close up, is there anything else that I guess I've triggered, thoughts that I've triggered, or maybe in you know, the comments that I sent you by email, anything else that you felt like would be useful for the listeners that you wanted to say?
For sure. I guess we've sort of covered two very, what I would call, disparate issues today. So I do want to also be really clear in acknowledging that we've talked about some of the stigma of bi men or men who have same-sex desires or urges. And we've also talked about attraction to trans women and trans femme women. So I just want to make sure that, to be very clear, that I'm certainly not conflating these and that we have talked about two separate issues. If someone is wanting to talk more about same-sex desires or things like that, it's okay to have those desires, acknowledge those and accept those desires, and there are communities out there for you. We know that the bias, the stigma for bi men is very real, in that, you know, we've got one study that says that bi men are only 46% likely to be open compared to 94% of gay men. And another study that was only a couple of years ago says that only 30% of bi men say that they struggle being open. So we know that this stigma is very real and that it's not going away. There are some really great groups out there. So for example, in Sydney, in Australia, there's the Sydney Bi Plus Network, which is amazing. There's also 2010 for younger people who are struggling with these kind of thoughts and feelings. Internationally, there's also the LGBT Foundation in Victoria. There's the Bisexual Alliance Victoria. And also for individual growth, I really recommend making sure that you do seek either a counselor or therapist if these thoughts and feelings are, you know, becoming or basically if you want someone to help guide you through these feelings. There's certainly nothing wrong with having these feelings, but it can help someone to help you accept these sorts of feelings. And so to make sure that you find a therapist or counselor that is LGBTI friendly and supportive, because there are still a lot who are not, and that can be very problematic for obvious reasons.
So that
would be, I guess, my my conclusive thoughts and statements.
Thank you. That's it for today's podcast. I hope you've enjoyed yourself. Don't forget to check us out at schoolofattraction.com. I highly recommend you check out my comprehensive and free dating personality test, which you can find by clicking personality test at the top of the page. Thanks again for tuning in, and I look forward to seeing you in my next podcast.